This is Women's Voices and Women's Stories on Yin Radio, and I'm your host, Sandy Billings. Today's show originally aired last December when we were cozying around the fire and taking a holiday break. The topic works well for long summer days also. It's about R&R. R for rest, R for relaxation, and perhaps R for reading. Because we have two authors reading from their work, books you might want to add to your summer reading list, from Western writer Kim Barnes and from science fiction fantasy writer Niecy Shawl. And then we'll wind up the show with a favorite relaxer, wine. Winemaker Coco Umaker gives us a peek into the world of winemaking. It's all about finding that relaxing time to curl up with a good book and a glass of wine. This is Yin Radio from KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, and today's show is called R&R. Niecy Shawl is a writer out of Kalamazoo, Michigan, who writes mainly short stories. Her most recent book is Filter House. It's a collection of short stories with a fantastic edge to them. Installment number one? It's two excerpts from that collection, which she read at Book People in Moscow, Idaho last October. This first one, Bird Day, started as a dream. She made it into a short story.
We sat in a circle on the side of the street. Some of us had lawn chairs or folding chairs we'd brought out from our houses, step stools even. We had a bunch of different kinds of seats we were sitting in. This was the day to commune with birds. It was a beautiful, cool, early spring morning. The pavement smelled clean and damp. I was wearing a warm, comfortable caftan embroidered with silver and dark colors. There were a lot of interesting-looking birds flying around low and purposefully, looking for the person they had a message for. It wouldn't do any good to get someone else's message, or to worry too much about whether one was ever coming. We relaxed and watched the birds and talked with neighbors who stopped by our circle. There were a few empty chairs. Eventually, someone might sit in them. Suddenly, a bird approached me. It was a sort of bird I'd never seen before, a large duck with a sheeny blue back, the blue of a clear sky just before dawn. I'd never seen a bird like this before, but I knew it was mine. It hovered awkwardly in front of me and gripped my index fingers with its webbed feet, pulling me. My heart lifted and I stood up. The duck flew backwards, its feet still wrapped around my fingers. I went with it. It let go and turned to fly forward, and I followed it out of the city. I wasn't about to let it get away from me. This was definitely my bird. I saw a great auk from the corner of my eye, huge, black and white, with a broad, brightly colored bill. It flew down a side road, but I stayed focused on my bird. The paved road had turned into well-graded brown dirt, dark and wet. I saw houses that people were building, open, pleasing structures. I lost sight of my bird, but went on in the direction it had taken out of the city. I stayed focused on it, even when I couldn't see it anymore. I heard the soft beating of its wings and knew it flew on before me. A stream joined me, running alongside the road. Daffodils joined the stream. Together, we left the house behind. I kept walking. I couldn't see my bird anywhere. I closed my eyes. The stream murmured to itself. The only beating I heard was my heart. How could I catch up? Without wings, how could I fly? I opened my eyes again and looked around. Where was I? Maybe this was where my bird had been bringing me. Maybe it had left me where I was supposed to be. Tall trees with their leaves just beginning arched over the road. It was really more a wide path than a road now. It moved among the tall trees slowly, one way, then another, quite casually, as if it knew where it was going, but felt no rush to get there. This didn't seem like a place to stop at, an end. Maybe my bird had left me because I would be able to figure out everything on my own from here. I saw sky through the leaves. I went at the path's pace till I came to the edge of the trees. It was quite an edge, only clouds beyond. Very beautiful clouds with popcorn-colored crests and sunken rifts full of shadows like gray milk. It was evening already, I could tell by the light. I had been following my bird all day. How had that happened? I had lost track of the time. That didn't matter, though. My bird did matter, and its message for me. It had to be around here somewhere. The cloud's lighter parts changed and became the color of the insides of unripe peaches. Against them rose black flecks, the flocks of birds flying away from us, flying away once more until next year. Silence stirred of my neck. Silence and a small wind fanned them out, so they extended upward and outward, up and out. Above my head, my bird flew forward over the edge. I went with it.
Science fiction fantasy writer Niecy Shaw is reading from her recently published collection of short stories, Filter House. Next is an excerpt from the short story she calls Watermelon.
Baby, 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 baby.
Cousin Alphonse must have thought he looked like James Brown. He looked like what he was, just a little boy with a big peanut head squirming around, kicking up dust in the driveway. Oneida thought about threatening to tell on him for messing his pants up. Even Alphonse ought to know better. He had worn holes in both his knees, begging, please, 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 into the broken microphone he'd found in Mr. Early's trash barrel. And she'd heard a loud rip the last time he did the splits. So nothing showed yet. Nida, Alphonse, come see what me and Mercy Sanchez found. Kevin Curtis ran along the sidewalk toward them, arms windmilling, shirt tails flapping. He stopped several feet off as soon as he saw he had their attention. Come on! Oneida stood up from the pipe rail fence slowly with the full dignity of her 10 years. One decade. She was the oldest kid on the block. Not counting teenagers. She had certain responsibilities, like taking care of Alphonse. The boys ran ahead of her as she walked and circled back again like little dogs. Kevin urged her onto the path that cut across the vacant lot beside his house. Mercy was standing on a pile of rubble half the way through, her straight hair shining in the noonday sun like a long black mirror. She was pointing down at something Oneida couldn't see from the path, something small, something so wonderful it made sad Mercy smile.
Watermelons, Kevin explained as they left the path. Grown all by themselves. Ain't nobody could have put 'em there.
Watermelons, Oneida corrected him automatically. The plant grew out from under a concrete slab. At first, all she could see was its broad leaves, like green hearts with scalloped edges. Mercy pushed these aside to reveal the real treasure, 4 fat globes, dark and light stripes swelling in their middles and vanishing into one another at either end. They were watermelons, all right. Each one was a little larger than Oneida's fist.
It's a sign, said Mercy, her voice soft as a baby's breath. A sign from the Blue Lady.
Oneida would have expected the Blue Lady to send them roses instead, or something prettier, something you couldn't find in an ordinary supermarket. But Mercy knew more about the Blue Lady, because she and her half-brother Emilio had been the ones to tell Oneida all about her in the first place. Four of them and four of us. Oneida looked up at Mercy to see if she understood the significance. Mercy nodded. We can't let no one else know about this. How come? Asked Alphonse. Because he was mildly retarded, he needed help understanding a lot of things. Oneida explained it to him. You tell anybody else, they'll mess up everything. Keep quiet, and you'll have a whole watermelon to all to yourself. I get a watermelon all my own? Watermelon, Oneida enunciated. How long it take till they're ready? They decided it would be at least a week before the fruit was ripe enough to eat. Every day they met at Ms. Nichols'. Mercy's mother had left her at Ms. Nichols' and gone back to Florida to be with her husband. It was better for Mercy to live at her grandmother's, away from so much crime, and Michigan had less discrimination. Ms. Nichols didn't care what her granddaughter was up to, as long as it didn't interrupt her watching TV, or worse yet, get her called away from work. Mercy seemed to know what the watermelon needed instinctively. She had them fill half-gallon milk bottles from the garden hose and set these to cure behind the garage. In the dusky hours after Aunt Elise had picked up Cousin Alphonse, after Kevin had to go inside, Mercy and Oneida smuggled the heavy glass containers to their secret spot. They only broke one. When the boys complained at being left out of this chore, Mercy set them to picking dried grass. They stuffed this into old pillowcases and put these underneath the slowly fattening fruits to protect them from the gravelly ground. The whole time, Mercy seemed so happy. She sang songs about the Blue Lady, how in faraway, dangerous places she saved children from evil spirits and grown-ups. Oneida tried to sing along with her, but the music kept changing, though the stories stayed pretty much the same. There was the one about the girl who was standing on the street corner, somewhere down south, when a car full of men with guns went by, shooting everybody. But the Blue Lady saved her. Or there was a boy whose mom was so sick he had to go stay with his crazy aunt because his dad was already dead in a robbery. When the aunt put poison in the boy's food, he ran away, and the Blue Lady showed him where to go and took care of him till he got to his grandparents' home in Boston, all the way from Washington, D.C. All you had to do was call her name. 1 week stretched unbelievably to two. The watermelons were as large as cereal bowls, as large as party balloons, but they seemed pitiful compared to the giant blimps in the bins in front of Farmer Jack's. Obviously, their original estimate was off. Alphonse begged and whined so much, though, that Mercy finally let him pick and open his own watermelon. It was hard and pale inside, no pinker than a pack of Wrigley's gum. It tasted like scouring powder. Oneida knew she'd wind up sharing part of her personal, private watermelon with Alphonse, if only to keep him from crying or telling another kid, or a grown-up even. It was the kind of sacrifice a mature 10-year-old expected to make. It would be worth it, though. Half a watermelon was still a feast. Cut that big one open, China is red to the right. Sweetest candy, sugar on the vine. Fine and dandy, now it's watermelon time. First you got to pick them up, stand it in the fields.
Niecy Shaw's recently published collection of shorts is called Filter House, published by Aqueduct Press. You can find Niecy on the website of the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America. It's www.sfwa.org/members/Shaw, S-H-A-W-L. Or you can just Google Niecy Shaw, N-I-S-I-S-H-A-W-L, Niecy Shaw. Installment number two. Kim Barnes knows Idaho. She was born in Lewiston. She grew up in North Idaho and now lives in Moscow, where, when she's not writing, she teaches at the University of Idaho. Kim is the author of 4 books, 2 fiction, and 2 memoirs, and she's co-edited 2 collections of women's stories. Kim was one of Yin Radio's very first guests, appearing live on the program to talk about and to read from her book, Kiss Tomorrow Hello, Notes from the Midlife Underground by 25 Women Over 40. It's a collection of short pieces that she co-edited with Claire Davis. Kim's latest novel was published in September of this year. It's called A Country Called Home. Installment number 2, Anna Maria Roque brings us Kim reading from her latest book.
One morning, author Kim Barnes, a 4-time novelist and Pulitzer Prize finalist, woke up with 3 words in her head. First, the river. Those 3 words now start off the prologue of her recently published book, A Country Called Home. The event that starts off the book is that of a young woman who is driving along the Clearwater River. She goes off-road trying to get to the river in a little Volkswagen Beetle and ends up getting entangled in this ancient bramble. The reader is then left hanging, not knowing what happens to her, as the story casts back to her parents, Thomas and Helen Daracott, who leave Connecticut to find a romanticized adventure of Idaho as part of the 1960s Back to the Land movement. There are 2 parts to the book. The first is the story of Thomas and Helen Daracott and Manny, a young man who comes to work for them. And the second part takes up the story of their daughter, Elise, and how she has to find her own way in this place she has been born into, a place her father believes is paradise. Elise's story is one of the unexpected and unbelievable, involving her synesthesia, mental hospitals, and the quest to find a place she can call home. We'll be listening to Kim Barnes as she reads parts of this novel. This audio was captured at her University of Idaho reading as part of the Distinguished Visiting Writer Series, sponsored by the Department of English and the MFA program in Creative Writing.
First, the river. Mountain wash of snow melt through granite, past fir, larch, red cedar, and pine. The canyon where the water widens, runs deeper, eddies in against rim rock, gullets the bank's soft palate. And then the car, sunbit to ruddy red, following the highway that parallels the river, matching it curve for curve. Late morning, the rain is nearly done, already a remembered thing. Swallows rest in their cool fists of mud. Trout do not rise, but hold in the submerged roots of cottonwood. Rattlesnakes thick with summer vole find fissures in stone, stretch themselves thin. The farmers have taken to their houses to nap, or they sit at the tables of their wives, drinking iced tea, creamed coffee, thinking their silence nothing more than what is wise, their women wind-scalded, planning cold cuts for dinner. Stock lean into shadow, ear flick of fly, twitch of hide and tail, all nearly motionless except the river and the car beside it, one channeling west toward the ocean, the other marking east. The driver is young, clean of face, frankly beautiful. Her mouth is simple, contained, her eyes noticeably gray. Chestnut hair, layers of lighter gold and darker brown, long links of it rising and falling in the wind coming in through the window. The steering wheel is loose in her hands, fingers gently curled, wrists relaxed. When she guides the car left, she leans her head left. When the road swings right, she moves with it, as though to a slow music. A simple cotton skirt, a quiet floral print, him hiked to mid-thigh. Her ankles are swollen, the heat. The air wings in, the feel of it at the hollow of her throat, lifting the fine hairs at her neck, along her legs, mineral and silt, musky alder.
The old dog rises to a sit, rests its muzzle on her arm, eyes clouded white, the silver of its rough faded gray. There are no cars ahead, none behind. Still, she remembers to signal left at the one-lane bridge condemned by the county, seldom used except by the locals, who, as they always have, weigh risk against utility. Wooden planks clack and rattle beneath her, right at the crossroad, then up and over Angel Ridge. Miles of river below her now, edged by fields of mown wheat, floodplains of stubbled alfalfa. She stops at the first side road leading back down the canyon face, considers, drives on. The skin of her legs is blushed with sun, sweat beneath her breasts and the bends of her arms. She spreads her knees, brings them together again, feels the moisture there. The second dirt road she forgoes, and then the third. At the fourth, she shifts into low, descends into the shelter of locust. A few months earlier, the grove would have been heady with sugar blossom, a vast black drone of foraging bees. She feels a small regret. Perhaps she should have come sooner. Still, there is the comfort, the respite from sharp light. The road narrows to a rutted path. The car's undercarriage catches dirt, then granite. She holds the wheel harder, hears the scree of metal against stone, the clatter of something torn loose. The dog tries to stand, to balance itself, but falls forward against the dash. The canopy grows dense with sumac, cottonwood, vine maple, the air through the window damp, like the inside of a cave, walls seeping. Birds flit and trill from their cover. A grouse beats up, quails sally from behind a mossy stump, take wing, disappear into a tangle of wild rose. Somewhere just ahead is the railroad track, running its spine of land, and then the river. Before her, an ancient bramble of blackberry, the small bitter fruit still pale, no sun to ripen. She noses forward against the shriek of canes raking the doors. The car groans and she pushes harder until the tires spin, the smell of sap and berry pulp mixing with the sweat of rubber. She presses in until the canes have bent and broken, let down their wounded limbs behind her, pushed up over the top. When the engine dies, she clicks off the key, imagines she hears the river, its constant thrum like the sound of sleep. She slides back the seat to give herself more room. It is easier to breathe, the jab of the steering wheel gone from her belly. She'll have to walk to the river now. There is no other way. She pulls the handle, pushes the door open, but the vines hold tight. An inch of space, no more. She resists the urge to roll the glass shut against the bramble. She has seen how quickly the cane snake can grow, like the kudzu her father once spoke of, how it reed the telephone poles, covered entire houses in a matter of days, alive with intent. She leans across the seat, thumbs open the glove box, and finds her father's straight razor, mother of pearl, blade newly honed. It is a tool she has known all her life, 17 years, memories of early mornings. She thinks she might cut her way out, but the blade only bleeds the vines. There is a flutter of movement in the cradle of her hips, a tightness low in her groin, like a fist squeezing from the inside, then letting go. An exhaustion so complete that she must let her head low back against the seat. I need to rest, she thinks, and then I will go to the river. The dog pants, whines, sniffs the breeze through the open window. She closes her eyes, hears the sawbugs cutting the air, the whisper of branches, the ravens overhead. She is held in that pleasant lull between waking and dreams. She hears her father talking in the gray tones of a serious man, his voice growing faint as she drifts closer to sleep. He is bidding her back, insisting that she stay in this place he has made for her, this paradise. She is cold. She wishes for her father's arms to lift her, to carry her to the house with its smells of cold bacon and laundry, to lay her in her bed, cup her head like a blessing, like the moment of her birth when he pulled her from her mother, that river of water and blood, and guided her into another world.
That was the prologue of Kim Barnes's A Country Called Home, set along the Clearwater River in Idaho in 1977. She read this at the University of Idaho as part of the Distinguished Visiting Writers Series, sponsored by the Department of English and the MFA program in Creative Writing. We now go back in time to 1960, as Barnes continues to read about the young girl's parents.
1960. Derek Hopp pulled on the highway, and Mandy watched the buildings of Fife disappear into the distance. He thought about his new home. It had taken most of the fall to finish the barn and dry in the little two-bedroom house. The house was blocky and plain, but the barn was beautiful, high-beamed, and tight. Still, Mandy wasn't sure he wanted to be leaving his shack along the river, moving into the room above the barn. But it was a good trade. Dr. K had told him so. "You're a grown man," Dr. K had said. "Better start acting like one." The hills were the color of rufous hummingbirds. Manny cracked the window just enough to let in a thin slip of air. Derek Hutt began to whistle some low tune, a waltz maybe. Manny had come to believe that Derek Hutt was a good man, but lax when it came to his duties. And Manny understood as well that he was not the only one who observed this. The townspeople knew without having to be told. They could see the fields lying fallow, the ditches choked with weeds that needed to be burned. They turned right onto the bridge and started up the grade. Derek had slowed the car, and Manny saw the covey of quail run for the cover of bramble, their top knots bobbing. "I wish I had a gun," Derek Hutt said. "We'd have partridge for dinner." Manny envisioned Derek Hutt in a tweed jacket, a leather patch at the shoulder, a funny cap. Derek Hutt pointed to a larger bird standing alone even as the others disappeared into the hedge. "What's that?" he asked. "Fool hen," Manny said. "Dumb as a shovel. You could probably kill it with a rock." Derek Hutt looked at Manny, then back at the grouse. He pulled off the road, eased his door open, and stepped out. Manny had killed enough grouse in his time, but there was something peculiar about watching Derek Hutt in his low shoes, sneaking toward the bird, a special kind of fascination in watching him bend slowly to choose a rock. The stone hit the grouse just at the wing. "Got him," Derek Hutt bellowed, then slipped and stumbled a few steps to where the bird twirled in the dust. Just as he reached the hen, it rallied and took off at a dead run for the brush. Manny laughed, delighted by the grouse's unexpected recovery, and Derek Hutt struggled to climb the barbed wire fence. His slapstick scrambled to keep his footing as he followed the bird down the steep and rocky hillside. Derek Hutt stooped once to grab a handful of rocks and pitched hard as he ran, missing each time. Manny whooped directions through the open window when the bird dodged, cheering Derek Hutt on. But then Derek Hutt stopped, arms outstretched, as though he himself were about to take flight. Had he lost a shoe, Manny wondered? Had the grouse died at his feet? Derek Hutt slowly lowered his arms and lifted his shocked face toward the car. Manny saw the look of confusion in his eyes, a kind of sad pain. He threw open his door, cleared the fence, and reached Derek Hutt in a few long bounds. The rattlesnake remained coiled, its tail trembling. It extended and hissed as Manny lifted a large stone and crushed the snake's head. Even in its death throes, it rattled and rattled, the blood curdling from beneath the rock, thick as syrup. Derricotte was breathing hard, his eyes fixed on the river as though he were on fire and might bolt for water. Manny knelt to examine the two punctures that oozed watery red. "We better get you to town." Derricotte didn't respond. The muscles of his jaws clenched. He turned and began walking toward the car. Manny helped him with the fence, holding the wires high and low so that Derricotte could crawl through, guided him into the passenger seat. Derricotte kept his gaze fixed on the road as Manny worked the unfamiliar clutch. "We'd best get you to Dr. K. You need that medicine." Derricotte shook his head. Manny didn't know what to do. Derricotte was his boss, his elder, a doctor. How could he overrule such authority? He turned left at the junction, eased the car into the driveway, hit the horn. Derricotte was pale, his breathing quick and shallow. He struggled out of the car and leaned against the fender as Helen appeared outside the door. She moved slowly toward them, then began running, the baby clutched against her shoulder. "What happened? What is it?" "Rattlesnake," Manny said. "He needs to get to town. I told him he won't go." Derricotte's ankle had begun to swell, the wound bluing around the edges. "Thomas," Helen said, "let Dr. K help." "No," he said, "no." The only word he would utter, even as he fell into bed, buried himself beneath the covers and began shaking so violently that the bed frame rattled against the wall. "What do we do?" Helen whispered. Elise had begun to cry, her wails growing louder the longer they stood in their indecision. Manny wanted to drag Derricotte into Fife, tie him if he had to, but Derricotte was the doctor, not him. And maybe it would be all right. He'd heard of a ridge runner who had gotten through more than one snake bite with little other than turpentine and whiskey. Manny waited as Helen stood with the wailing baby in her arms, her eyes fixed on the window that looked out over the river, listening as Derricotte called her name from the bedroom. She lifted her sweater as though in slow motion, moved Elise to her breast, and Manny saw the fear and helplessness in her face. He wanted to kill Derricotte himself for not paying more attention, for causing her such pain, but maybe he was as much to blame as anybody. How many times had he started to warn Derricotte about the snakes, but didn't? "Let me take Elise," he said, and held out his arms. Helen looked at him and began to cry. "Here now," he said, and pulled them both toward him. "It's going to be okay. We'll make it okay." He held them against his chest, wishing he could keep them there, keeping them safe. But Derricotte was calling louder. Manny eased Elise from Helen's breast and began a gentle sideways swaying. "Go on," he whispered. "We're okay." Helen touched the baby's head, then raised her palm to Manny's face. It happened so easy that in the days to come, Manny would believe he had dreamed it. Helen's mouth pressing against his. He closed his eyes, the breath gone from his lungs, but still he could taste the sweetness as he listened to her step out of the room. Over the next 24 hours, Manny kept watch over Derricotte as the skin of his swollen legs split and seeped like a tree blazed for pitch. It was too late for antivenin, but Dr. K sent medicine for the pain, and Derricotte's moans became weak whimpers, and finally, nothing more than the guttural breathing of deep sleep.
And now for part three of her reading, Barnes jumps forward again to the story of Elise.
And finally, 1977. The lawn stretched down the hill to the road, and the road circled the complex of low-roofed buildings before leading back to Fife. Beneath each... By the way, I have to stop and tell you this. If you've been to Orfino, you know that the high school, whose mascot is the Maniacs, is right next to the mental institution, which is right next to the state prison. So, as Bob says, the children of Orfino can look out the high school window and see their futures before them. I tried to put the high school and the mental institution and the prison all together, and I was afraid no one would believe it, so I had to simplify it. Beneath each oak, maple, elm was a bench, and on each bench was a brass plate etched with names of families who had donated to the Clearwater Hospital Foundation. Green knuckles of daffodils punched up through the thawing earth. Morning and evening, deer browsed the budding leaves of mulberry and laurel. Elise watched them from the mill room, where she would stay until she had eaten some part of what they placed in front of her. After breakfast, lunch, dinner, the aides ran gloved fingers along her gums, under her tongue. They weighed her clothes, weighed her food, weighed her again, and then her clothes again, whose seams were inspected for pennies she might have sewn into the hem. They watched her urinate, defecate. They charted the length of time it took her to brush her teeth and cautioned her to spit only once. Even her saliva was enough to tip the scales. The psychiatrist who came from Folgate on Wednesdays said it was temporary dementia brought on by anorexia that had caused her to hurt herself. Pastor Maggie came as her spiritual advisor and insisted it was Satan. She didn't know what to believe, which way was right, and so she prayed and she took her medicine. She read the Bible, and she wrote in the journal the counselor said would help. She didn't tell the counselor about the night of the rain, the music she had played with Todd beside her, the water flooding the church floor. She'd run upstairs to warn Todd and his parents. By the way, this is a big flood that really happened in 1996. Some of you probably remember it, but so this is a February flood that has happened. To warn Todd and his parents, but they were already bunched together, whispering. It was she who had brought the sin into God's house, Mrs. Maggie told her, and now they would all be punished. Her memories came to her like a dream. Their injunction that she purge herself with fasting and prayer. Finally, when starving herself had not erased the color of music, she took the Bible they had given her and let it fall open to the book of Mark. And if thine eye offend thee, pluck it out. Starving yourself will not cure you, the psychiatrist said. Seeing colors when you hear music is a condition known as synesthesia. It is not uncommon. Why then, she wondered, had fasting brought such peace? The first few days she'd craved everything. Oatmeal, hamburger buns, black plums. But then the congregation had prayed over her and the hunger had gone away. She felt she could live forever without food. Was it a sin that she had lied to Manny, telling him she'd eaten when she hadn't, flushing soup down the toilet, the empty bowl evidence of her appetite? The more complex her deception, the more satisfied she felt. An omelet might take an hour of preparation, chopping the ham, grating the cheese, keeping the heat low enough not to scorch, and then the whole of it thrown to the chickens, who fell upon the eggs with cannibalistic delight. She wanted to get better, to go back home to Dog and Manny. When called to the mill room, she marched forward, reciting from the Song of Solomon. He brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. A chant that did not vary in tone as she slid into her chair. Honey and milk are under thy tongue, a kiss of sweet tea. Apples, pomegranates, cinnamon, spiced wine, a slice, a seed, dark juice. Let my beloved come into his garden and eat his pleasant fruits. Still, no matter how hard she tried, she couldn't swallow more than a few bites without her stomach knotting. She did what the counselor suggested to keep her mind off the food and engaged the other patients in dinner conversation. She asked Rodney, round-bellied and balding, which stone was your favorite? He had collected them, first as a hobby, then as an obsession, the garnets and tourmaline giving way to chunks of dull granite, buckets of pebbles hauled in off the river that filled his bedroom and spilled into his kitchen. And then came the grass and ferns potted in loose soil, an introduction of butterflies, night crawlers lifted from the dewy lawn, two rubber boas, and a clutch of spider eggs that erupted and spread to the corners of every room. A dozen starlings, trapped and released, ladybugs and bats, squirrels, and a small maple dug from the neighbor's lot, an electronic sprinkler system. Finally, the floor had collapsed, producing a pleasing landscape of arroyos in the basement. A biosphere, Rodney insisted, a perfect creation, don't you see? But a favorite stone, he had none. All rocks were equal in his eyes. Each evening after dinner, Elise read a chapter of Pilgrim's Progress to Sarah, a plump 35-year-old given to filling her orifices with spoons, candles, candy canes, anything she might pilfer and privy away. Sarah thought that Pilgrim wore a buckled hat and shoes, that he was questing not for salvation, but for turkeys. Elise had tried at first to dissuade such interpretation, but had finally given up, allowing Sarah to weave the story of fateful and hopeful in the celestial city into a tale filled with Indians and muskets and maize. In the last hour before bed, Elise would pull on her coat and walk Mr. Lambert out to the patio for his nightly look at the stars. Moderately tall and handsome, he appeared sane in every way, clean, courteous, and intelligent. Only his stance seemed a bit off. He tilted to the left, chin tucked, as though he were being reined into a tight circle. He needed a steadying hand at his elbow, which Elise offered, and as they pointed and named the constellations, he would smoke a single pipe of tobacco. White mustache and neatly combed hair, Elise thought he looked like a British gentleman. But when she had asked where his family was from, if perhaps he'd been raised in England, the corners of his mouth had drooped, and he'd begun rolling his lower lip. No, he said, not England. Surely she could see he was from Nazareth. His shoulders slumped forward, the pipe fell from his hand, and he began braying like a donkey. Ah, Christ, Sarah said, he's the Virgin Mary's ass again. And she hurried to tell the attendant. The preacher had told Elise that it would help if she were baptized, that it would wash away her sins. The staff couldn't argue against such religious expression, and so the preacher and his wife had come, and along with the aide, convened in the tub room, once used for hydrotherapy, now vacant except for the porcelain tub itself, long and solid as a crypt, surrounded by nothing but gray tile. Elise, dressed in a white hospital gown, stepped over the high rim and sat with her legs extended, cold water to her waist. Why, Pastor Maggie had asked, are we gathered here today? So that I might be washed in the blood of the Lamb, Elise answered. Then I baptize you in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. And he had taken her head in his hands and tipped her back until the water covered her face. Sister Maggie shouted and danced a tight step between the tub and the wall. The minister beamed and was proud in a way her father had never been. Since then, it had become part of her free time ritual to bring the water to the edge of overflowing, ease herself into the tub, and slide beneath the surface. At first, the aide had bellowed her name, jerked her up by her hair. I won't let myself drown, Elise had promised. Watch and see.
That was Kim Barnes reading from her latest book, A Country Called Home.
Another reading suggestion for your holiday pleasure. You can find A Country Called Home at local booksellers. It's published by Knopf. This is Yin Radio. Today's theme is R&R. We're exploring good reads for the break, and some good wine to go with those books is up next. Our third installment is the last one today. It's about the one thing that goes with any good book, or with cheese, or chocolate. I like it with pretty much anything. It's wine.
Red, red wine goes to my head, makes me forget that I still need you so.
Coco Umaker is on the leading edge of Idaho winemaking. She's making wines in the Clearwater Valley, in and around Lewiston, Idaho. And while it may sound revolutionary, or even crazy, it's not a new concept. In fact, it's nostalgic. 100 years ago, the Clearwater Canyon was a prime wine grape-growing region. The first grapevines were planted by a Frenchman in 1872. More than 200 acres and more than 40 varieties grew in and around Lewiston. In 3 world fairs, Lewiston wines took the prize over California wines. Then came Prohibition. As counties, then states, then the nation went dry, the wine industry dried up too. Clearwater Canyon Cellars in Lewiston is on the leading edge of a new era in winemaking history. The winery is a collaborative effort. With her husband, Carl, and 3 other couples, Coco Umaker makes wines with locally grown grapes. Coco is the winemaker, something she learned from years of apprenticing at other wineries, and supplemented with formal food science studies. With her experience, all she needed was a vineyard. She explained as we walked into the vineyard. And this is what you married.
Yeah.
I remember talking about that when we met. You said you married the vineyard.
We married in the vineyard, actually right here. And we planted the vineyard before we got married and then realized, geez, this was like having a child. We should do this for real and get married.
There are multiple aspects to the business of running a vineyard and a winery.
So Carl and I grow the grapes, or grow this vineyard and manage this vineyard on our own. It's our own business. We sell the grapes to the winery, as you know, of several other vineyards in the area do. Mm-hmm. We are also partners in the winery, so we essentially buy our own grapes back.
Sure.
And at the winery, we have partners in the business, and there's 3 other couples, all good friends, very diverse.
8 may be a lot of partners, but these 8 managed to collaborate very nicely.
Little wine always helps those business meetings, too.
I think it would help all business meetings.
Yeah, we have we can't let ourselves drink too much because we just don't get anything done. Yeah. So we have, you know, our nice glass of wine, everybody chills, and then we put the wine away, and then we take care of business, and then we drink the rest.
Coco has been practicing fermentation for the last 8 years and growing her own grapes for the last 4. She shared some of the basics of winemaking and the process of growing grapes. Oh, by the way, the background noise is traffic. The vineyard is just on the edge of town.
When you say this is a Merlot, this is a Syrah, let's do some of the basics.
Okay.
Those are about a variety. Those are
right.
About like a scientific grouping of some sort.
Yep. It's just a group of, there's different types of Syrah. For example, we've got 2 different clones of Syrah. So they're both Syrah, just like, for example, what kind of analogy can I make here? Slightly different clones. So, I mean, you and I are both human. We're both female. But, I mean, you are slightly different than I am. And that is basically the same there. We have several different clones of Cabernet, several different clones of Chardonnay out here. And they just have slight, very subtle differences in flavor and characteristics. But in general, you know, a Cabernet and a Syrah, they're very typical. There's a lot of things you can always expect from those grapes.
And that matters more to your end product wine than does the climate that year? And
everything plays a role. There's a word they use oftentimes, it's French, it says it's terroir. and it describes kind of the place that the vineyard, that the grape came from, I should say. And terroir describes the wind and the climate and the soil and the viticulturist that grew the grapes and that exact spot. You could talk about terroir within a vineyard. I mean, the terroir on that side of the vineyard is slightly different than the terroir that where we stand. And all those things add up and affect the flavors you're going to get out of that grape in the wine. It has a huge effect.
As does when you pick it and then how you process it.
The time you pick it, how you process it, the winemaker has a huge impact on that. So you could have Syrah at, you know, three different vineyards, even in this valley, all harvested on the same exact day, and even if they were the same clone of Syrah, they could taste extremely different. Extremely different. Now, here we have eight different varieties, and when I say variety, that means eight, like we have Syrah being one variety, Cabernet, Cabernet Franc, Viognier, Chardonnay, Riesling, Muscat, Canelli, Merlot. We have orange Muscat too.
Oh, yeah?
Not much of that, but just a little bit, yeah. We do Muscat actually for the family as well.
Who do you?
Yep. We do a little bit of red wine every year for the family, and then the Muscat, Canelli, and the orange Muscat because my grandfather loves it, and he's 93, and you got to give the guy what he wants.
Yeah.
Know.
And everything's producing. How long does it take for grape vines to start really producing for you?
On the third year, you can get a crop, but it's really not considered a producing vineyard until 2000. You know, till the fourth year, and then the fifth year, it's considered mature. And you're getting a full crop off it.
Coco and Carl picked all the grapes from their 3 acres. They reserved only 1,000 pounds for the family. All of these grapes and others from the region gave the Clearwater Canyon crew a busy summer.
And we did about 14 tons at the winery. So that's 28,000 pounds.
How much acreage does it take to get that much grapes?
Usually get about 3 tons an acre off. You know, when you're growing premium wine grapes, you generally keep the tonnage per acre down. So, like I say, we only got 8 tons off this place. The rest of the grapes came from a vineyard down in Peck, near Orofino, right at River Bend. Uh-huh. And then another vineyard over in Clarkston, just up Fleshman Way, off on 13th Street. And one over in Cougar Ridge, which is, actually, you can see it from here.
The Clearwater Canyon partners all participate in the winery as weekend warriors, and after work and during lunch breaks and whenever they can. But it's not just a weekend hobby. For Coco, it has also become her career and lifestyle.
I'm finishing my PhD at WSU. I'll be done hopefully next summer, or this coming summer, so summer of 2009. And I'll be teaching at LCSE. This January, I'll start a part-time teaching job while I'm trying to finish up my dissertation and manage all this, so it's a lot.
Her PhD will be in food science. Her project is dealing with, what else? Wine. She's studying microorganisms involved in wine spoilage. Winemaking is Coco's love, and she's made it her life.
A lifestyle. You don't get rich making wine, at least not around here. It's... You do it for the love of it, for sure.
Wine up, wine up, wine up on you, on you. I've made my mind up on you, I've got my eyes up on you, cause you turn me, turn me, turn me, turn me on.
You can find Clearwater Canyon Cellars at cccellars.com. Well, we're wrapping up this reprise of the R&R show, and I hope we've given you some inspiration for enjoying the summer and for taking a break. I leave you with a song by singer-songwriter Alison Crowe that harkens back to Niecy Shaw's bird story. It's called This Little Bird. Thank you. Thanks for joining me for Yin Radio. You can contact us at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's Y-I-N radio at V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. Or you can find us on MySpace. You can catch past shows and sign up for podcasts at yinradio.org. Yin Radio is now heard on 5 community stations in the Pacific Northwest, Michigan, and Tennessee, including KYRS Thin Air Radio in Spokane. That's 92.3 and 89.9 FM. And internet streaming at kyrs.org. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP in Moscow, Idaho by VP Foundation and me. I'm Sandy Billings. Until next week.
Just to be with you, just to be where you are.